Chapter 4. Warriors in an Age of Peace. The samurai loom large in the scholarship of the Tokugawa period, 1600 to 1868, also known as the Edo period, or simply early modern Japan. Despite being known as a time when commoners wrote and produced knowledge more than ever before, when commoner urban popular culture eclipsed the Kyoto-centric highbrow culture, samurai remained central to macro-historical analysis. For some types of history, especially diplomatic and political histories, this makes sense. Samurai rule achieved its peak during the Tokugawa period. Nobunaga eliminated institutional religion as a political, economic, and military force, even though religion, broadly conceived, helped legitimize and promote political action. And until the very end of the Tokugawa period, the nobility and emperors in Kyoto no longer had the authority they once did. They depended on the shogun's largesse and sent ambassadors to the Tokugawa shogunate headquartered in the city of Edo, modern Tokyo. No emperor even considered challenging the warrior regime during the Tokugawa period. Scholars of economic, institutional, intellectual, religious, and cultural history all address the role samurai played in either constraining or fostering changes in early modern society. One could even argue that the real age of the samurai began in the Tokugawa period. Some historians have depicted this as a dark time when a putatively rigid status system kept commoners in their place, denying them access to the decision-making processes at the top and condemning them to physical toil at the bottom. Others see this as a relatively bright era when health and standard of living were generally good compared to European countries at the time. Likewise, popular culture, literature, art, and theater are viewed as either sites of resistance against or vehicles for escape from the pressures of warrior rule. In comparative East Asian history, Japan is considered either similar to China and Korea because they all underwent bureaucratization at roughly the same time, or as fundamentally different because Japan was ruled by warriors, unlike its neighbors. Tokugawa Ieyasu represented the last generation of warlords who experienced a life of war. After the early 1600s, they were simply lords. The Matsudaira clan, Ieyasu's birth family, gave him as a child hostage to the Imagawa clan in exchange for help fighting against the Oda. Hostages and marriage were the two methods for securing alliances among warlords. But he was kidnapped en route and handed over to the Oda, with whom he lived for several years. He returned to the Imagawa during a hostage exchange involving one of the Oda's sons. This might sound like a rough childhood, but he was scarcely mistreated. He received an education under the Imagawa, led armies on their behalf, and married an Imagawa woman. Ieyasu lived with the Imagawa until they were defeated by the Oda, after which he returned to his homeland and took control of the Matsudaira. He became Nobunaga's ally and eventually his vassal. Nobunaga trusted Ieyasu, and for good reason. When Ieyasu was forced to decide between maintaining his alliance with Nobunaga or killing his own wife and son under Nobunaga's orders, they were suspected of secretly colluding with enemies, Ieyasu chose the latter. During the Warring States era, loyalty could not trump ambition. When Hideyoshi took over Nobunaga's armies, Ieyasu joined forces with him until Hideyoshi died. Ieyasu had agreed to help Hideyoshi's son, Hideyori, rule, but he eventually fought against the warlords who supported Hideyori and emerged victorious at the decisive Battle of Sekigahara in 1600. Ieyasu then extracted the title of shogun from the emperor in 1603 and turned on Hideyori, who was holed up at Osaka Castle. Ieyasu finally defeated Hideyori and his few allies by attacking Osaka Castle from 1614 to 1615, a siege that ended with Hideyori's death. Richard Cox, head of the British East India Trading Company in Japan, recorded in his diary, "They say the taking of this fortress hath cost above 100,000 men's lives on the one part and other, and that on the Prince Hideyori's part no dead man of account is found with his head on, but all cut off. Neither can the body of Hideyori be found, so that many think he is secretly escaped, but I cannot believe it." June 19, 1615. His suspicions were correct. Hideyori was captured by the Tokugawa and beheaded along with his 8-year-old son. Ieyasu destroyed the Toyotomi clan shrine, thus ending any possibility of a counter-rebellion based on the same strategy that the Minamoto had used against Taira Kiyomori in the late 12th century. Ieyasu himself died of natural causes in 1616, shortly after the siege, at age 75. Tokugawa Ieyasu created the last warrior regime in Japan, and his successors ruled as shoguns with few real challenges from the court and lords until the 19th century. The shogunate established obligations due from the lords and expectations from samurai, outlined in a 1615 document titled Codes for Warrior Households. Some of the articles in the code continued to emphasize themes found in older warrior precepts, such as studying the civil arts along with military arts, living frugally in accordance with one's station in the military hierarchy, and avoiding frivolous activities like drinking and gambling. For commoners, the shogunate issued constantly changing and sometimes contradictory edicts that defined a variety of crimes. It also had the last word on foreign policy, but depended on the lords to conduct international relations on its behalf. Japan's political authority was centered in the city of Edo, but Japan was not centralized. There was neither a national army nor a national tax. Lords, ensconced in their domains, maintained separate currencies, legal codes, and courts. Many features associated with the last samurai regime had their roots in the 16th century. The main difference between the Tokugawa period and its predecessors was the degree to which those features became more strictly defined during the 17th century. During the Warring States period, anyone could be considered a daimyo if he was powerful enough, but from the early 17th century onward, a man had to be officially classified as one. The image of the samurai as a relatively strictly defined group distinct from other types of people in Japanese society can be attributed to the Tokugawa period. In earlier times, warrior was a plastic concept. Some men were born and raised as warriors or served as military vassals or retainers, but others might have been part-time warriors, pursuing other occupations when not at war. In the Tokugawa period, only the lords, daimyo, or shogunate, could confer that status. Hideyoshi initiated a process of pacifying Japan, later inherited by the early Tokugawa shoguns and largely complete by the late 17th century. He issued an edict known as the Sword Hunt that forbade farmers from owning weapons of any kind, and ordered them to hand over weapons to local warrior authorities to be melted down for use in a great Buddha statue. But, as in any pre-modern society, regulations enacted by the sovereign were never completely and uniformly enforced. Some commoner elites, such as village officials or commoners with warrior roots, still held weapons in secret. Villagers used muskets for hunting, but they were locked up in village headmen's offices and given only to those with written permission from a local authority. Perhaps Hideyoshi's farthest-reaching act was a countrywide land survey used to determine taxes based on agricultural output. It doubled as a primitive registry. Villages, their residents, and the number of people in a resident's house, including servants, were classified as commoners rather than warriors, thus separating warriors from commoners spatially and economically. But it was only under the Tokugawa shogunate that warriors became distinct from commoners culturally and politically. In general, warriors could no longer live in the countryside except in a few domains where a portion of the samurai population engaged in farming as part of their military obligation. Instead, the shogunate's laws forced samurai to move into castle towns that served as domain capitals, leading to massive urbanization. Edo became the largest city in the early modern world. Merchant activity flowed from the villages into local cities as the Tokugawa population grew. Commoners in the countryside were no doubt glad to see the samurai population leave their villages, but samurai officials made regular forays into the countryside to assess production there. The shogunate also controlled a third space, the borders between Japan and European countries. Catholic missionaries traveled mostly throughout southern Japan, where nearly a quarter of a million Japanese, some of them warriors, converted to Catholicism. Although these conversions might have been true acts of faith, the reality is that where missionaries traveled, merchants followed. In the 16th century, merchant activity increased the wealth for warlords in the south and helped them gather European weapons and ammunition. Of the three warrior hegemons, Oda Nobunaga had nominally accepted Catholicism in Japan, probably as a way to antagonize and weaken his Buddhist institutional rivals. But Hideyoshi and Ieyasu suspected foreigners, their overly zealous and exclusive religious beliefs, and the potentially troublesome southern warlords who hosted them. Ieyasu's prohibition against Christianity in 1612 was directed primarily at the top. Although the edict outlawed Christianity in general, its implementation targeted lords and samurai converts. This changed in 1637 when rebels in the southwestern region of Shimabara used Catholic imagery, namely crosses and crucifixes, on their flags during the rebellion. Across Japan, the shogunate required people to join local Buddhist temples to prove that they were not Christian, and authorities forced converts to publicly renounce their faith. The shogun also banned visitors from foreign countries, except from Japan's neighbors, and, oddly, the Dutch. They promised never to bring Catholic-related objects or texts into Japan. Overseas Japanese could not return to Japan, nor could Japanese travel abroad. The shogunate shut down ocean-going ship construction, and all foreign ships had to arrive in Nagasaki, far to the south, far away from Edo. More than just imposing a Catholic ban, the shogunate also wanted to monopolize any foreign contacts, taking away profitable European connections that mostly southern warlords had once developed. The Lords, Daimyo. The first issue facing the early Tokugawa shoguns was how to prevent challenges from the warlords themselves. The shogunate removed many warlords from their bases of power and put them into unfamiliar territory. During the first 50 years of the Tokugawa period, there were at least 281 instances of lords being relocated. A little more than 200 daimyo were completely stripped of land and title, and roughly 170 samurai were promoted to the rank of daimyo. The shogunate awarded another 200 or so lords with more land. It executed particularly threatening enemies, dissolved their domains, and redistributed their land to Tokugawa allies. The Tokugawa clan existed as a first among equals and maintained a tenuous dominance throughout the Tokugawa period. It controlled 60,000 warriors and nearly a quarter of the land in Japan, including the area around the major cities of Edo, Kyoto, Osaka, and the sole official international port in Nagasaki. These lands supplied the shogunate with the resources it needed for mundane operations, including paying its samurai and providing support to the court and emperor in Kyoto. Those same lands funded the shogunate's national responsibilities. When extremist samurai assassinated some Europeans in the 19th century, the shogunate had to pay the indemnities to the families. The Tokugawa had their own samurai, loyal to them. Most of them served as bureaucrats within the shogunate. The Tokugawa shoguns could not reach into another lord's domain and withdraw men or resources. The samurai in the 250 to 300 domains that existed throughout the Tokugawa period were loyal to their local lord's clan. Although the shogunate could force a daimyo to supply samurai labor for infrastructure projects, such as building dams or bridges, the shogunate could not bypass the lord. It was the lord's responsibility to fulfill the order. If the shogunate needed more samurai to deal with a rebellion or defend against foreign invasion, it would call upon the most loyal daimyo to mobilize their own samurai. The 19th century tested the limits of the shogunate's prerogative. Sometimes lords close to the Tokugawa clan answered the call to mobilize against rebels, but when the Tokugawa clan most needed help, some lords demurred, to disastrous effect. Daimyo staffed all of the top advisory positions in the shogunate, creating a group that, on the one hand, had their destinies tied to the fate of the shogunate. But as lords, they enjoyed relative autonomy in their own independent domains. Theoretically, no lord could have more than one castle, and even repairs to a castle had to be approved by the shogunate to prevent turning a castle repair into an expansion. Even Ieyasu's closest allies were not exempt from this rule. One vassal lord who fought with Ieyasu during the Battle of Sekigahara was punished for expanding his castle. The shogunate confiscated 90% of his land and sentenced him to home confinement. With some exceptions, the shogun relied upon the daimyo to interpret the rules as they saw fit, to enforce them as needed, and to mediate relations with Japan's neighbors. Thus, relations with the Koreans to the east, the Ryukyu Kingdom to the south, and the Ezo lands to the north were all managed by daimyo who lived closest to those countries. The lord of Tsushima Island, located between Japan and Korea, acted as a diplomat between the two countries and monopolized Korean-Japanese trade. The shogunate bestowed the rank of daimyo upon the northernmost clan in Japan, the Matsumae, solely because of their role as a go-between for the Tokugawa and the aborigines in Ezo. But lords had no jurisdiction across domain borders. When a samurai from one domain committed a crime in another domain, only the Tokugawa regime could order the arrest. The shogunate also wanted to prevent neighboring domains from sending troops into one another's territory, which could be the first step in building a regional army used to overthrow the shogunate. This edict had its drawbacks. When the shogunate needed help putting down an insurrection in the south, an event known as the Shimabara Rebellion, 1637 to 1638, lords close to the conflict refused to help, fearing that doing so would break the shogunate's rules. Subsequently, the shogunate allowed troops from any domain to cross a border to protect the coasts from invasion or quell insurrection if a domain needed assistance. To prevent rebellion, the shogunate also wanted to eliminate the age-old practice of using marriage to form strategic alliances. Article 8 in the Codes for Military Houses explains, "Marriage is the union symbolizing the harmony of yin and yang, and it cannot be entered into lightly." The Chinese I Ching Book of Changes says, "Marriage is not to be contracted to create disturbance. Let the longing of male and female for each other be satisfied. To form a factional alliance through marriage is the root of treason." Thus, all daimyo marriages had to be approved by the Tokugawa regime. Early in the Tokugawa period, the shoguns enforced rules strictly. To maintain stability in the realm, clans were expected to practice primogeniture. A lord's oldest son, regardless of competency, would become the next daimyo. If a lord did not declare an heir before he died, and if the shogun did not approve the heir himself, then the family lineage could be dissolved and the domain confiscated. Samurai from those domains became masterless samurai, ronin, and had to travel to find employment, often ending up in Edo. Complaints from some lords, and the rising problem of masterless samurai causing trouble in Edo, led to the loosening of strict rules beginning in the latter half of the 17th century. Thus, while primogeniture was still the norm, lords might delay announcing a son's birth, lie about the birth order of several sons in order to choose a suitable heir, or even postpone announcing the death of a daimyo until the clan's advisors could choose an appropriate successor. Under a policy of alternate attendance, Sun King Kotai, the shogunate required lords to travel between their home domains and Edo every other year. This practice began as a military expectation, not a requirement. After all, since at least the 11th century, warriors had spent time away from home performing guard duty or some other military service in Kyoto or Kamakura. During the early 1600s, going to Edo to serve the shogun and have an audience with Tokugawa Ieyasu was part of being a close ally. But by the 1640s, the practice of alternating time in Edo and the home domain became institutionalized and expected of all lords. Alternate attendance was rooted in a pre-Tokugawa custom of hostage exchange. Daimyo wives and children lived in Edo permanently to discourage daimyo rebellion. Wives and children were relatively free within the city, but wives were generally forbidden from leaving at all, except for pilgrimages to religious sites in the Edo hinterland. In fact, inspectors working at checkpoints along the five official highways that connected Edo to the rest of Japan always monitored samurai women closely. A samurai woman heading away from Edo could indicate the beginning of a rebellion as lords sent their women to safety. For the same reason, travelers heading toward Edo were checked by the inspectors for any guns. Heirs could travel to their domain homeland, but their visits could never overlap with their father's presence in the domain, again to prevent rebellion. Lords expected their teenage heirs to visit the places they would one day rule, but what could attract them to a life in some small countryside domain? After all, they grew up in the political, commercial, and entertainment capital of Japan. One clan advisor even scolded an heir who, repeatedly citing illness, a common excuse for shirking duties, had refused to visit his domain for many years. "Most daimyo heirs of your status have already made the trip to the domain. This may lead to rumors that your illness is grave, or that there is some discord between you and the lord. People may also be wondering whether you have postponed making the trip to Tosa because you lack the ability to govern." In addition to keeping a tight leash on the lord's close family, the alternate attendance system drained the lords economically. Even though there was no national tax on the daimyo, the shogunate had ways of extracting economic support from the lords. Daimyo provided funds, labor, and materials to repair the immense Tokugawa Castle in Edo and other Tokugawa castles located in other cities, including Kyoto. Lords had to maintain walled compounds in Edo, with a mansion for the family, quarters for full-time servants and guards, barracks for samurai who lived in Edo, stables, training areas, and even gardens. When lords moved back and forth from Edo biennially, they brought with them a retinue of samurai appropriate to the size of the domain as well as a large support staff. Smaller domains might bring only several hundred samurai, larger domains sent several thousand. Edo compounds and the alternate attendance system together composed 50 to 75% of a domain's annual budget. The shogunate coordinated travel so that neighboring lords did not serve in Edo at the same time, perhaps to prevent possible Edo-based collusion between neighbors, or to ensure that a lord was always in a particular region in case of uprisings or foreign attack. For the most distant lords, the trip could last several months, and the clan was supposed to pay for food and lodging in the expensive, officially approved inns along the highways. And weather did not always cooperate. Travel back and forth from Edo every other year was a long, burdensome, and costly process. The daimyo were happy to see alternate attendance abandoned when the shogunate weakened and collapsed during the mid-19th century. Nonetheless, even the strictest laws could be skirted or bent because all of the shogunate's prominent counselors were themselves daimyo and thus sympathized with daimyo burdens. A lord who was busy reforming his domain's finances or otherwise dealing with complex internal political issues could beg off alternate attendance by claiming illness, the go-to excuse for any samurai bureaucrat desperately seeking a method to protest or skip some duty. A lord required to contribute to a large infrastructure project, such as construction of dams, would also receive a temporary release from alternate attendance. Early in the Tokugawa period, the shogunate expected daimyo to repair Edo Castle, but in a surprising reversal, the castle went unrepaired while the shogunate sometimes lent money to daimyo to repair their own castles. The shogunate strictly monitored the daimyo in the 17th century, but eventually these inspections became a ritualized affair with few consequences. As long as the lord maintained the appearance of following the shogunate's laws without fail, there were acknowledged workarounds to the daimyo obligations. Geographically, the most threatening warlords were located far from Edo. A little less than a dozen of the roughly 100 or so of these outer Tozama domains represented some of the largest landholdings in Japan, other than those of the Tokugawa clan itself. Many of the outer lords were classified as such because they were not Ieyasu's vassals before 1600. Others received outer daimyo status and were placed far to the south to hem in potentially threatening daimyo. Politically, these Tozama lords had no access to the decision-making process in the shogunate, but economically they influenced the region around them, especially lords based in the southwest. Some were so powerful, such as the Shimazu clan in the Satsuma domain, that even Tokugawa Ieyasu could not relocate them in the early 17th century, as he had done to weaker daimyo. Despite the Tokugawa clan's preeminence, it still had to negotiate power with warlords such as the Shimazu in order to solidify its national authority. The oldest and largest outer clans had once been the Tokugawa clan's peers, not subordinates. Their claim to power was independent of the Tokugawa. Although the Tokugawa period might have been an era of relative peace, it was not void of tension. Once a year in the Satsuma domain, the samurai dressed in full armor and meditated upon their ancestors' defeat at the Battle of Sekigahara. Warrior mothers in the Choshu domain told their boys to sleep with their feet facing Edo, an insult to the Tokugawa. For Tokugawa period samurai, support of or conflict with the Tokugawa clan became part of their identity. The vassal, Fudai, lords, served Tokugawa Ieyasu before 1600. Almost half of all lords were vassal daimyo, numbering from just over 100 to a peak of about 130 in the mid-19th century. Some of the most senior vassal lords began as samurai vassals to Ieyasu, men not considered daimyo during the 16th century. As the Tokugawa clan and the shogunate expanded, so too did the number of vassal daimyo. Although none of their domains were as large as the largest outer domains, they staffed all of the important offices within the shogunate. Theoretically, the shogunate expected them to serve in times of need. Their destiny was tied to that of the shogunate. But they were also potential rivals. Ieyasu confiscated lands from several powerful vassal lords over minor pretexts and even eliminated some clan lines entirely. By the end of the Tokugawa period, however, the title of vassal was merely symbolic. It granted a lord the privilege to hold positions in the shogunate, but it otherwise guaranteed no special treatment. Many of these daimyo refused to help the shogunate when it attacked rivals in the mid-1860s. A smaller group of related shinpan lords, never more than around 20, had kinship ties to the Tokugawa clan itself. the most trusted decision makers, typically came from these families, who were supposed to be the most loyal to the Tokugawa and the shogunate. Their domains were located close enough to Edo to protect it, but not too close. Allies and relatives could still be a threat, even in a peaceful era. Some had no land holdings at all. One clan, the Mito, was exempt from alternate attendance and instead resided permanently in Edo. Of these Shinpan lords, the so-called Three Houses, the three major branches of the Tokugawa clan, used the Tokugawa surname and supplied heirs to the shogun when one was not otherwise forthcoming. The Samurai Life Cycle. With some exceptions, birth was the only entrance into the warrior status group. Samurai girls learned how to care for a future husband and his family, while boys learned what it meant to serve the domain, its lord, and his household. Samurai children, even those of modest means, grew up in a household staffed with commoner servants. Families felt pressure to keep up appearances, even if they could not afford it. Family planning through abortion or infanticide was a common option for samurai and commoners alike. Health problems compounded a family's financial challenges. Children of both statuses were susceptible to the same diseases, such as smallpox, which could be fatal. Some samurai children, especially those of elite families, faced at least one danger that most commoners did not: lead poisoning. A samurai woman's makeup contained lead that could pass to infants during breastfeeding. In general, commoners also maintained a more diverse diet, while samurai suffered from a thiamine deficiency called beriberi because they ate too much polished rice and few other grains and little meat. Ironically, commoners who worked in the fields were usually more physically fit as well. If a samurai boy survived childhood, he passed through several phases marked by changes in clothing and hairstyle until he became an adult, officially, sometime between 12 and 16 years of age. As with everything else in early modern Japan, there was no uniform approach to samurai education. In general, a boy began his studies around 7 years of age outside the home, with tutors and mentors acting as his primary source of early education. Friendships formed at this age were important. Childhood peers became colleagues during their adult working life. Mentors and older boys might court a younger boy romantically, even securing permission from the father to establish a relationship. This could blossom into a close platonic friendship in adulthood, though sometimes these affairs became violent. In the 18th century, daimyo started to build domain schools where young samurai studied classical Chinese texts, including Confucius's Analects, or Japanese military tales such as The Tale of Heike, which recounted the war between the Taira and Minamoto families. In addition to basic reading and writing skills, boys learned ethics and what it meant to be a warrior. Not all samurai education was created equal. Inequality within the warrior status group began at a young age. In the 17th century, boys born into higher-ranking samurai families typically received more education than those at the bottom, but in general, education and literacy rates rose over time. Not surprisingly, samurai teenagers studied martial arts, either through private training halls, dojo, at a domain school, or a mixture of both. Even martial arts became a source for discrimination among samurai. Only wealthy, higher-ranking samurai might learn how to ride a horse, which was considered a martial art, or study how to shoot from horseback, yabusame. Swordsmanship, however, could be studied by warriors of all stripes. A typical practice session might include engaging in predetermined attack and defense drills, kata, with wooden swords, and repetition of basic techniques. But lords and high-ranking samurai dominated certain styles, such as Yagyu Shinkage Ryu, the first institutionalized style of swordsmanship. It was named after the Yagyu family, whose headman taught swordsmanship to the Tokugawa shoguns and received daimyo status for doing so. Like the relationship between artists and shoguns during the Muromachi period, 1336 to 1573, the Yagyu masters met other intellectuals through their connection to the Tokugawa shoguns, and that interaction influenced how swordsmanship was institutionalized and taught. In some domains, samurai students who studied an elite style like Yagyu Shinkage Ryu received a stipend for their equipment and training. They even demonstrated their skills in front of their local lord as part of annual events. Lower-ranking samurai also studied swordsmanship, but were limited to lesser-known, newer, or even local styles. Those students often did not receive stipends or permission to perform before their lord. Since these styles did not have as close a connection to warrior officialdom, however, their practitioners could be more creative in how they developed their art. Low-ranking samurai engaged in freestyle fencing, the forerunner to the modern sport of kendo. The shogunate expected samurai to be prepared to mobilize in case of insurrection or invasion, but most samurai had little interest in military training. They rarely practiced beyond their teenage years and, as adults, only attended the occasional mandatory training sessions. Tokugawa samurai had become sword-wearing bureaucrats. Primarily, samurai used martial arts as a way to connect to their warrior heritage or to interact with men like themselves. They were less concerned about practical application in combat. In many domains, military preparedness was no longer a fact of life. During the latter half of the Tokugawa period, lords no longer required the lowest-ranking samurai to own rifles or carry bows. In fact, martial skills needed to apprehend criminals were considered the lowliest of arts, because samurai rarely conducted physical police-type work. Outcasts and other marginalized commoners hunted down and arrested criminals, guarded prisoners, and tortured and executed offenders. In adulthood, a Tokugawa samurai's life revolved around his family and the domain. Honor, as far as there was such a notion, was defined by one's conduct and loyalty to the lord's family. Gone were the days of serving a powerful warlord who might have commanded respect by his prowess on the battlefield or his political acuity. The Tokugawa custom of primogeniture did not always guarantee an able or charismatic lord. Thus, samurai worked to uphold the domain's reputation rather than to act out of love for a daimyo. They idealized the legacy passed down from warring states-era predecessors and honored fictitious ties to famous clans such as the Minamoto or Kyoto nobles like the Fujiwara. A samurai's career trajectory was determined, in order of importance, by the rank of the family, seniority, and talent. The oldest son typically inherited his father's position. This included a job that might be as menial as guarding one of the gates to the local domain castle for several months out of the year, or as important as becoming one of the lord's closest advisors. The situation was worse for younger brothers, who were not guaranteed consistent work by the domain. Since the oldest brother inherited the family property as well, the younger brothers were at his mercy. If they were lucky, they could marry into an heirless warrior family or be adopted by a childless samurai. Otherwise, they had to find some temporary employment or abandon their samurai status. Samurai who tired of searching for menial domain jobs, especially second and third sons, left the samurai life to become scholars, writers, priests, and teachers. Older scholarship about Tokugawa samurai exaggerated the lack of social mobility within the samurai status. There is a certain intuitive appeal to this argument. Warriors before the Tokugawa period could rise through the ranks based on their exploits in war, but in an age of peace, few opportunities existed for a samurai to showcase his talents. Recent scholarship tends to correct past assumptions about samurai inertia. A samurai born into a high-ranking family might begin his career with simple work. As he grew older and demonstrated talent, the domain advisors would give him more responsibility. Low-ranking samurai faced more difficulties rising through those social ranks. But even then, especially when domains faced fiscal or political crises, some could be promoted based on talent alone. Most rank-and-file samurai were not busy with official duties. Samurai who lived in Edo during their tenure on alternate attendance worked for a few hours every day, and then, with permission from their lord, left the domain compound to go on pilgrimages to Edo-area temples and shrines, essentially a form of sightseeing. Merchants set up stalls to sell their wares, while street performers and fortune-tellers flocked to take advantage of tourists, transforming some temple properties into permanent fairgrounds. Even today, Asakusa Shrine in Tokyo attracts tourists as it did throughout the Tokugawa period. Aside from gambling, drinking, and, if they could afford it, visits to the pleasure quarters like Yoshiwara, samurai studied literature, poetry, music, martial arts, and philosophy alongside commoners or samurai from other domains. Many samurai supplemented their meager hereditary income with small-scale work. Called by-employments, these included micro-farming, weaving, pottery-making, trade, and handicraft production, like toys and umbrellas. But not all samurai used their time so nobly. Some of the lowest-ranking samurai gambled, begged, and borrowed their way through life. Katsu Kokuchi, a 19th-century samurai, recounts his life as a ne'er-do-well in an autobiography written as a warning to his son, the statesman Katsu Kaishu. Kokuchi was born the second son of the Otani, an undistinguished samurai family connected to the Tokugawa clan. His father was not a warrior, but the third son of a wealthy, blind moneylender who was adopted into the Otani family. He then married into the Katsu family and became its heir. Despite his newly acquired samurai status, Kokuchi could not find any steady employment and lived on a meager hereditary stipend, as many lowly samurai did. He eked out a living by renting out a small plot of land, buying and selling swords, begging, stealing, and engaging in other shady activities, some of which landed him in trouble. Like many samurai, he spent much of his life in debt. One samurai writer complained about poor warriors. They head for guard duty wearing outfits that they have conned the pawnbroker into temporarily restoring to them. Once they have come back from guard duty, they return the outfits directly to the pawnbroker. Their servants mock them for this. A family history written during the 1930s details similar hardships for a samurai clan from the Mito domain. Despite living hand-to-mouth, samurai families were under pressure to maintain standards of appearance. As the samurai proverb tells it, a hungry samurai keeps a toothpick in his mouth even if he has nothing to eat. They had to maintain a certain number of retainers commensurate with the family's rank. In theory, these retainers would join the master of the house during military campaigns, but with war unlikely, this practice became a meaningless custom. Thus, samurai hired commoner men on a temporary basis to accompany them during ceremonial events. The commoner-samurai gray zone. Did commoners ever dream of becoming samurai? Wealthy rural commoners often used their position and wealth to accrue warrior privileges, such as the right to carry swords or use their surname in official documents. But for the most part, they did not want the drudgery of a low-ranking warrior job. Still, some commoners during the 17th century petitioned to receive samurai status. Kion was one such commoner who dreamed of becoming a warrior. His grandmother, the daughter of a samurai, raised him, so he grew up listening to her stories about warriors. As the fourth son of the family, he could not hope to carry on his family's trade, which would pass to his oldest brother. So, in 1655, at age 16, he began researching his family's history in order to secure warrior status. He asked neighbors to share documents they had, and he visited the local Buddhist temple to look for old gravestones and records. He eventually abandoned his quest and became the heir to another commoner family, but he still used his research to co-author a history of the region. It was rare, but possible for a commoner to achieve warrior status. An elite commoner could marry into a low-ranking warrior family and become its heir, as Katsu Kaishu's father did. Domain officials granted warrior status to well-known fencing teachers of commoner status in order to employ them as official sword teachers. Wealthy merchants who lent daimyo large sums of money acquired samurai status and worked as economic advisors to the domain. A poor samurai could sell his status by officially adopting a commoner as an adult. Often, these examples of status crossing were only superficial, used to show off to other commoners, and carried no obligations or offers of actual warrior employment. In any case, a commoner wealthy enough to buy samurai privileges would not desire the lowly, unprofitable work of a samurai. Complicating the divide between commoners and warriors were those who occupied a gray zone. In many domains, a group of people known by various titles such as rural samurai or landed samurai lived in the villages and claimed, falsely or otherwise, to have warrior ancestry. They could carry swords or use a surname in an official capacity and represented domain interests in the countryside. In parts of the Kanto region outside of Edo, when wandering gangs of young men caused disorder in the 19th century, the shogunate asked landed samurai to establish and train local militias. Daimyo bestowed landed samurai status on rural entrepreneurs for their contributions to the domain, such as bringing new lands into production, which added to the domain's tax base. In Edo, too, entire families known as the Thousand Men of the Same Mind, Senin Doshin, who originally worked as guards during the Warring States period, served as minor officials on the outskirts of Edo. These families interacted socially, often intermarried, and maintained a strong communal identity. Some even trained together in their own style of swordsmanship, Tenen Rishin Ryu, in order to express pride in their warrior ancestry. Shogunate officials sometimes acknowledged them as warriors. After all, Senin Doshin worked for the shogunate. At other times, the shogunate revoked their privileges, considering them mere commoners, much to their chagrin. Despite such warrior-commoner gray zones, samurai writers claimed that no commoner could ever become a true samurai. The most widely read military text of the Tokugawa period, the Military Mirror of Kai, stated, "Even if a townsman imitates a samurai, his heart is still that of a merchant. In the heat of battle, he would worry about losing his property. He lacks the essence of Bushido and would not be of any use." In this case, the term Bushido does not refer to an institutionalized code of behavior for the samurai, as no such code existed. It simply indicated the fundamental difference between samurai and commoners. A samurai was born into his status and performed whatever duties were expected of him, even if that work overlapped with commoner occupations. Other than paying taxes and providing corvée labor, a commoner had no such intimate ties to the warrior regime. For more than 260 years, the warrior regime kept non-samurai out of its decision-making process, while also attempting to limit, often unsuccessfully, what commoners could do in their daily lives. It is no wonder that most people, even some samurai, were glad to see warrior authority collapse.